Ziegler.
Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast for Better Call Saul on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Alexis.
And we're here today to talk about Season 5, Episode 1.
Magic Man.
What'd you think of this episode, Alexis?
I thought it was a little bit slow in some areas, but it did a good job setting up the things that we are going to see this season. What did you think?
I really like this episode, I think. Better Call Saul, I'm glad I did my rewatch because I kind of understand, you know, what they're trying to do and how they go about it. Mm-hmm. And so in the slow scenes, like you mentioned, I don't get as impatient or I'm trying not to get as impatient as I did maybe last year right. when Mike's dismantling a car for ages. But I think it was really good, like especially this first Gene scene. I don't know where they're going with it, but...
Oh my God.
I don't know what the fate of Jimmy will be.
I can't wait to talk about that whole energy.
Okay. I mean, we can get right into it if you want.
Let's do it.
Okay. We start off with Gene bugging out. Even though it seems like there's nobody really looking for him or asking around for him. There's nothing on the police scanners. And he eventually realizes that and he returns home and the paranoia begins to wear off. But just then, the cabbie shows back up, claiming he recognized him from his commercials and demands that Gene say the line.
This is the cabbie from the last season.
Yeah, so if you remember back to season four, episode one, he went to the hospital and then he got a cab home. This guy was sort of eyeing him in the mirror.
And he had an Albuquerque, whatever the team was, air freshener thing hanging from his rearview mirror.
Right, and that freaked Jimmy out, Gene out. And so he says the line and the guy leaves and then Gene calls up Ed, the disappearer, who says, hey, it'll be double the price this time. Cause you're too hot, too much heat on you. And he's going to pick him up Thursday at the same spot that he dropped him off. But Gene suddenly changes his mind for no real reason.
Yeah.
We can talk about that. And he decides he's going to fix this himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't seem like there's any real outside influence to him making that decision. It just seems like he's kind of fed up of being a mouse, basically being a bald mouse.
I think it ties into sort of like the whole thing that brought him here to this situation was when he saw the kid stealing the CDs, DVDs, whatever he was stealing, and he pointed him out to the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt really shitty about that afterward, and he collapsed, you know, essentially having a panic attack.
Right.
And then he went to the hospital and came back, but. Yeah, you get the feeling like he's not able to live this life any longer. It's been who knows how long since Saul became Gene, and he's just sort of over it.
He is. Also, that dude's fucking energy just being radiated at him probably didn't help.
That guy is so good.
It was wonderful.
I feel uneasy just watching this guy on... I don't even know why. It's like something about his demeanor, something about his face... His just a threatening personality.
Yeah, it's like it's not just, you know, straight intimidating. It's intimidating on multiple levels. There's that like overly familiar, creepy fan kind of energy.
Yeah.
But then there's the sinister, I could probably kill you in your sleep energy.
Right. And he's got
equally terrifying.
This other dude standing behind him
who's,
you know, equally
not
as menacing,
just
in that Gus sort of way, you know, the silence.
Right.
I looked this guy up. His name's Don Harvey. I've seen him in other stuff. He's playing this character named Jeff, who's the cabbie. And yeah, he's just incredible in this scene. Do you think this guy is an assassin?
I don't know necessarily that he is an assassin, but I think he might be part of something. Hmm. I think this guy might be somebody. The sinisterness is too real.
Okay. I mean, I
or
think...
he could just be a serial killer just in general, you know?
Okay. Also yeah. Just, what are the odds? How sad is that of an ending for Gene? Just like a random serial killer shows up.
That would suck. That would be like being crushed under a castle. Yeah.
and also like, yeah, this guy's fantastic. This I don't think he's an assassin. I think he's just a fan, but also fuck him, because like this is probably just Bob Odenkirk's life, right?
Yeah.
People coming up to him saying, do say the thing, say the line.
Yeah.
Now point and say it again.
Right.
All right. See you later.
I've seen him in interviews about Better Call Saul, and he seems like he's maybe a tiny bit over it.
I mean, that's
kind of
the way it goes with you know, people who get famous for a particularly quirky character like Jesse.
Right.
Everybody, like Jesse, Aaron Paul will be walking down the street and people will shout across the street at him, yo, bitch, like just all day, every day.
Something, something Funyuns.
Right.
Yes.
Come on, people. Be human beings.
Be cool.
He mentions when he's talking with Saul that he'll do better next time. Like,
that,
oh, you're rusty.
That was the line. You know what? That was what really made me think, shit, this is something.
Yeah.
Why would there be a next time?
Now you say that, I think.
Yeah.
You could be right. You could be right.
Even if it's just a overfamiliar fan thing, that's still, it's awful.
It is. Yeah. It makes me wonder what next time this guy has in mind.
Exactly.
Is it, because he mentions at the end, like, oh, whenever you need anything, just give, you know, Omaha taxi company a call and I'll be there. They'll find me never within, you know, more than 5 minutes.
Yep. I'll never be more than 5 minutes away or something like that. Something to that effect.
So it makes me think, oh, maybe he's just saying the next time I see you when you call for a cab, you'll say it again and you'll be better. Or it could be
I
plan on showing up in your life again.
Yeah, that's so cheery of you.
I mean,
so
I'm trying
optimistic.
To give him the benefit of the doubt. I don't like to judge people solely based on their face.
It's not his face, man. It's his whole fucking energy that makes you think, I don't ever want to see this person again.
That's true. That's true. So let's talk about Robert Forster.
Let's do it.
Who's the Disappearer Ed.
And also alive again somehow.
Yeah. So I don't know. I didn't see any information on how this scene was filmed. I assume it was filmed around the same time that El Camino was filmed. Because I think Robert Forster is looking very similar in those scenes.
Might be a composite thing too.
It could be that. It could be some
trickery.
Of editing.
Right.
But yeah, it was kind of shocking to see Robert Forster show up again. Because if you don't know, he died of brain cancer, I believe, several months ago. It's been like before El Camino finished or released.
Yeah.
He had already died. So yeah, it was strange seeing him, but I'm glad he got one last scene.
I never know exactly how to feel about posthumous appearances. I guess if you've already okayed it, it's fine, but...
Yeah, yeah.
The idea of using a person's likeness to create content after they die seems a little ethically weird.
They can't choose what content that is.
Yeah,
they can't, like,
exactly.
Yeah, it's strange, and I know we're getting to the point where that's becoming a real issue.
Oh, yeah.
Between, you know, holograms dancing on stage at Coachella to, you know, Princess Leia showing up in a movie after she's gone.
Like, right.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we haven't figured out about that, but the tech has advanced so fast that it's already happening. So how do you deal with that? I don't know. The courts will figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. This happens every time.
Yeah.
New technology exists, basically. Right. There's a whole moral gray area around how to use it.
Yeah. And some people will get screwed by it early on, probably. People will feel like, oh, they did an injustice to my loved one who passed. And people will be angry, and eventually we'll figure it out.
There will be people who will straight up say, I never want to be a hologram, who will become a hologram. It'll suck.
Yeah, I think Robin Williams put some stuff to that effect in his will.
Prince. I don't know if he put it in his will, but he was publicly known to be against holograms.
Yeah, yeah. I read something about that.
Smart of Robin Williams. Because that's definitely, he seems like the kind of person who would be ripe for exploitation post-mortem.
There's a shot here that I really like when Jimmy says, I'm going to fix it myself, or Gene, where it's just a slow push in. And it kind of gives you the time to sort of look at him and see what he might be thinking, because it is a very confusing moment. It's one that, like, you don't quite know why he's feeling the way he's feeling, but when you sit there and sort of stew on this with him, like, he's going to have to run again. How many times can he do this? Like, this is a pattern, right? This is like getting blackmailed. It doesn't end.
Right. Yeah. You're never safe.
Yeah.
And Odenkirk did a great job. You could almost see his mind change with that slow shot.
Yeah, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to modern day.
2004?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yes, I think so.
Jimmy explains his new business model and persona to Kim, and he's extremely excited about it. Kim is less excited, but says he should do it if he really wants to.
She is visibly less excited about it, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
She has to, like, calm herself down a little bit before she catches up with him.
Mm-hmm. And he signs paperwork, and he's officially Saul Goodman. Like, everybody's wondering, oh, when is Jimmy going to turn to Saul? This is it.
Yep, there it is. And
you can go to the courthouse, you can check the records. He is Saul Goodman now.
He is Saul Goodman. And we got this little shot that was drawing our attention to the fact that he signed his name on his official paperwork, Jimmy Saul Goodman McGill.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me wonder if that's going to come back in a Gene scene next season.
Hmm.
If maybe that's some way that they're going to trace him back to his actual...
In a Gene scene?
Identity. Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how it would come back in a Gene scene. I could see it coming back in like a Nacho kind of way, or a Lalo kind of way, or something like somebody who knows one of his real names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair.
Because Gene is pretty much off the grid. Like, I think it would be really hard to trace Gene back to Jimmy unless you had like his fingerprints or something.
Yeah.
Because he's been arrested, obviously. That's the whole thing that started this thing with his brother, is he got arrested. Mm-hmm. So they have his information on file. And if they caught him again, if he were arrested and they ran those prints, I think around 2004, you might have like cross-state police databases. I don't know. We have law enforcement people and lawyers who listen to this show, so correct me if I'm wrong, but they could probably run his prints through a computerized database and find him.
I'm less worried about the cops doing it and more worried about
criminals.
Yeah, criminals doing it. I just, story-wise, it would feel satisfying to me to have that roundness where we're all coming back to where we started, which is Jimmy McGill. And this is my stupid crackpot theory, I guess. I guess I'm calling my shot now, but I think we will get the last few shots of the last episode of the show.
Be
Gene shots.
Okay.
Will be Gene scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would make a certain amount of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I could definitely see, like, I don't know. Does Saul die at the end of this? Does Saul survive? Jimmy, Gene, whoever he is at that point?
We don't have enough information right now.
Right.
But it would be really fun to see the process.
We've been speculating for a few seasons now what they're going to do with these Gene scenes. Are they going to give us more as time goes on? It seems like that's not the case, but that could change in the final season, because there is one more season. There's season 6 already slated.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we get more of him.
It does seem like all the Gene scenes that we've had so far, though, are within like maybe even a week of each other, at most 2 weeks.
They're really closely tied together.
Yeah.
Especially the last couple of seasons. Mm-hmm. They just follow each other. Like, we pick up right where we left off with him.
Right. Didn't you notice that he picked up even on the same book that he was reading?
Uh-huh. Yeah. That Moon's a Balloon book that he picked up in season 3, I think, is what he was reading. And then we go 2 whole seasons before we see, he picked that book right back up.
In the same spot.
Sort of shows him settling right back into the patterns that he was in before, which maybe wasn't the best idea since he got recognized. All right, let's talk about Lalo.
Yes, please.
Opining about Werner Ziegler.
Werner Ziegler.
He's trying to figure out what he could be up to while interrogating everyone in the taco shop.
Mm-hmm.
And Nacho and Crazy 8 say some of the people are complaining about stepped on product. And Lalo says, show me. And once they get to the stash house, Lalo finds some shit that isn't theirs is being sold.
Mm-hmm.
I think Peter Gould, who is now the showrunner of Better Call Saul, just learned the word scales because they use it twice in this episode, and it's not in the lexicon of Breaking Bad universe at all. Like, I don't think I've ever heard the word scales in Breaking Bad. I'm convinced that in the off season between writing seasons 4 and 5, they just learned what this word is and said, oh, fuck, yeah, we love that word.
It's quite possible.
A homeless, a vagrant, yes. We can do all of those, well, but I've got a better word.
Specifically, a homeless or a vagrant who buys drugs from dealers.
Oh, yeah, in this context.
In this context.
Certainly. But I don't know. They used it twice in the same episode, and I was like, oh, interesting.
That word just passed right over me. I didn't even think about it. That's why you're here. You're the smart one.
I like this whole scene with the gutter and the drugs and stuff, because it doesn't really need to be in there. Like, our story is concerned with the high level drug stuff, like Gus building a super lab, right? To cook pounds and pounds and kilograms of meth.
But I think that they need to show us this little stuff, because this is how these two entities are going to start fucking with each other, which we will get a hint of later on in this episode.
Oh, yeah. I'm specifically talking about the scene where the before Lalo shows up to the stash house.
No, I know
what
you're talking
about. The drugs come down the gutter, down the downspout.
I'm just thinking that part of the reason why we're seeing this, we're seeing how this works, is that these little, like, the small level of the operation is what is going to get messed with by these two, by Gus and the Salamancas, buttonheads, basically, trying to screw each other over.
Okay.
It's the little guys who are going to feel it and go to jail.
I think everyone's going to feel it,
Everyone's going to feel it eventually. I've seen Breaking Bad, sir. Hey, you know what? It breaks bad.
It does.
Like, real bad at the end.
Yeah,
like, a lot of people
good.
Die. They get all shooted up. They get shooted up big time.
But I like it for another reason, too. Because, yes, it may foretell things to come. But also, it just adds a lot of flavor to this world.
It does,
like, seeing these low-level drug operations. Like, what's the minutia of getting drugs from one person to another and getting paid for them?
Right.
It adds a lot to the world. Otherwise, you could just see it as like a very isolated sort of thing, like with Gus at the top and his decisions just sort of, you know, are cordoned off from the world in a weird way.
Yeah.
But seeing all these low-level things, and Breaking Bad did that because we had an insight through Jesse, but here we don't, right? We don't have any low-level stuff.
Right. It feels a lot more sanitized in an interesting way.
Yeah, but scenes like this serve to sort of open that world up.
Absolutely.
And I'm happy they're doing that stuff.
Yeah, I like it too.
All right, then we move on to Kim giving Jimmy a couple gifts. Jimmy comes up with a promotional offer for his cell phone clients, and Kim tries to understand Jimmy's decision to become a second-rate lawyer, essentially. And Jimmy says he can't be his old self. He needs a fresh start.
Yes. I like the line, "I got that for Jimmy McGill." That's really something right there. Yeah.
Jimmy's gone. Forget about Jimmy.
Jimmy's dead.
Yeah, and there's this dance they're doing throughout this whole scene, which I really love. This is maybe my favorite scene of the entire episode. And it's not like a flashy scene. It's not fancy. But man, Kim and Jimmy are the heart. They're the core of this show. And every time I see these two amazing, excellent actors playing off of each other and sort of like trying to figure out what the other one wants. Like, why are you doing this? Why can't you understand sort of that this is detrimental to not just yourself and your business, but our relationship?
They could hear me out. They could just talk about it, but they're not going to do that, clearly.
Well, Kim would. Jimmy,
kind of, but only to the point where she isn't to blame for anything. I don't think she's willing to take a lot of the blame in the relationship upon herself.
Yeah, I think you're right. Every time she sort of pushes him, like, she has pushed him into a new con, right? Like, he said, okay, well, clearly you don't like these cons, and she said, oh, we can't do it. Then she comes back to him and says, okay, we can do it, but only for good.
Right,
and
right.
And I'll define what's good.
That's why I was going to say good is apparently expanding a bank branch.
Well, that's the thing. There's a huge trust issue in their relationship. And I don't know if Jimmy sees it. I think he sees it. I think he understands that Kim does not trust him at all. He has brilliant ideas, right? He's extremely good at what he does, which is con people, get them to trust him, and then use that trust for his own ends.
Right.
But Kim does not trust him in any way at this point.
And I think you're right. I think he does know it, but I think he's in a little bit of denial. And
he thinks he can control it, I think.
And he's also well, we'll talk about that tomorrow, but there's some overcompensation happening.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's this line in there where he says, I go too far and you pull me back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Jimmy really means in that sentence, what he's trying to say is I go too far, or I go as far as I want to go and you hold me back. Like, you are the thing keeping me from becoming the person I would become.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to become that person, but I also want to be with you.
Yeah.
And you're holding me back from being the thing I want to be. But also, like, he stays in the relationship.
Yeah. And she does too. I mean, Kim has her own line in this scene. Mm-hmm. That is basically, how do you think that this reflects upon you as a person? And what I think she actually means is, how do you think this reflects upon me as a person with my very legitimate practice?
Yeah, I think she's concerned about her own image, especially mm-hmm. after that Schweikert and Coakley party where Jimmy just totally made a fool of himself, right?
Yeah.
Talking about that Aspen trip and all that. Like, that's one of the reasons she doesn't trust him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, her image is sort of at stake too. But I think there's a lot of trust issues and resentment on both sides of this. Like, I wouldn't have said that there's much resentment from Jimmy up until sort of this episode.
Yeah.
But I think he does with that line. He resents what, you know, what shape her influence has on his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange because we know that he's doing bad things and she's trying to keep him from doing that.
Yeah.
But that's not how he sees it.
Right. He sees it as he's almost like flowering into this, the ultimate expression of all the things that he was doing before,
mm-hmm.
which is to say Slip and Jimmy, except it's actually working this time.
Right.
It's being lucrative, possibly.
Yeah. The chimp with the machine gun.
What?
That is a Chuck quote from earlier seasons.
Man.
He calls Jimmy with a law degree a chimp with a machine gun.
That's fantastic.
It is.
I only rewatched seasons 3 and 4.
Same here. No, it wasn't in those seasons.
I assumed.
So Lalo goes to Gus's chicken farm, and mm-hmm. Gus confesses, quote unquote, that Werner was working for him and stole 2 keys of product. So they had to kill him, and he replaced the stolen product with inferior local meth, and he apologizes to Lalo for that. Then Lalo asks about the construction project that he knows about from his Werner call, and Gus takes him to a chicken chiller, which I thought they called the chicken prison
the first time
I watched it.
Which, to be fair, kind of.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, what is a chicken farm but a chicken prison?
What is a prison but a place that the beings inside cannot leave?
Yeah. And then Mike says hello and only hello to Lalo. And then Bolsa tells Gus and Lalo that they have to make this work. This relationship has got to work out.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciated this scene. It's an excellent scene where Lalo comes in and he's sitting down with Gus and Bolsa. And Gus is apologizing/not apologizing.
And Lalo is so clearly not buying any of Gus's shit. I mean, even when he turns from one Bolsa to Gus and he does this fucking neck bobble thing. I'm like, oh, you cocky bastard.
Oh,
look
yeah.
at
I mean,
you.
Lalo is.
He's great. I like him so much as a character.
I don't know that arrogant is the word. He is very confident.
Confident, yeah.
Extremely confident in himself.
And he has every right to be up to a point,
yeah.
I think.
I mean, he's probably rich. He's very mm-hmm. charismatic. He's good looking. Like, what's not to love about Lalo? I love Lalo.
I love Lalo too.
Gus does not love Lalo.
No, Gus is not even a little bit okay with his shit. I think he hates that cockiness.
Yeah, yeah. It's a swagger that Gus does not, never displays. Like,
yeah.
It's anathema to Gus.
He's professional all the way.
Right.
At least in his presentation of himself.
Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing about Lalo and Hector is how different they are, but how different they are in relation to Gus as well.
Mm-hmm.
And how they're essentially the same to him because they're both, you know, not about the business. They're both not serious men.
Yeah.
Well, they're serious in a way, but not the same way that Gus is.
Right.
They're not calculated as much, although Lalo's getting there. I'm super excited to see how Lalo shapes up in his battle against Gus.
Lalo is like a more dangerous Hector because he's smarter. I think he's just as bloodthirsty
mm-hmm.
as Hector. but he's way smarter and way more charismatic.
He's also reckless. I think like that that parking lot scene where he's chasing Mike sort of shows how reckless he is, just crashing through just another car.
Pushing a car out of the way with his car.
To try and stay on the trail of Mike. And that's very reckless. You can get the cops in your business that way.
Yeah. Who was it? It was Juan Bolso who even told him, like, hey, this is not how we do things north of the border. Because there's, I guess there's probably just more scrutiny.
In Guess's apology, not apology here, he talks about these two keys that Werner stole, which is amazing to me because there are so many subtle like subtexts in this conversation.
This conversation is absolutely chock full of subtext.
And those two keys are one of them. The two keys, if you remember, Hector's organization started out taking four keys of coke at each of their meetings. And then Hector said, oh, we're going to push this. I forget exactly when he says we're going to push it, but they push it up to five. And then during their final meeting, before Nacho takes out Hector, they've pushed it to six. Or maybe, no, it's right after. So what happens is like Hector gets taken out. And then right after that, the other guy in this relationship who I don't even know his name, but the guy that Nacho goes to these meets with, said, we're going to take six this time. It's what Hector would have wanted. And they take two. So they've taken two extra keys of coke every time. And so there's a subtext of like, Werner stole two keys from me. You guys have stolen two keys from me. That can't go unanswered. We had to kill him. Like, man, the threat here is subtle, but powerful. And I really like that subtext.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, we can tell that that's what it is. His, we know that deadpan, like, expression that Gus gets when he is being very serious and he wants you to know that he is being very serious. And Lalo, he knows it too because all the jocularity is gone from his face.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of this conversation,
I do wonder how much Gus knows about Lalo, because at the end of this conversation, you know, Lalo brings up the construction project and and Gus says, it would be easier for me to show you, which telling Lalo, like, let me show you is the perfect thing to make Lalo feel comfortable, right? Because Lalo through the show is always like, show me. Show me. In this episode, I think it's at least once he says, show me.
Yeah. When he goes to Stash House. He wants to go immediately.
Yeah. And that's kind of his thing is just show me. And so when Gus says, let me show you, I think that is a way to sort of smooth over this relationship a little bit. Like, I know what's going to put this guy's mind at ease, and it's going to be me showing him, me letting him get his eyes on the things that he's so suspicious about, which totally fucking backfires because Gus doesn't have all the information.
Yeah.
In a fantastic way.
He definitely knows. He knows that Lalo has been sniffing around his operation. I think it's also a way for him to show that he can mess with the Salamanca's side of the operation, this side of the border, just by delivering inferior product and getting people mad about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like
he's in control of that part of it, so he can slip in some garbage and there's not a lot that he can do about it.
No, and like Juan says in the next scene, it's basically he's got the control because he's earning the cash right now. And all of the cash at this point is flowing through Gus because all of the product is flowing through Gus. And so if Hector doesn't have Gus, or Lalo doesn't have Gus, then they've got no money. And that's what Don Eladio cares about.
Right.
So there's I mentioned how, you know, this thing about showing you comes back to bite Gus in this scene where he goes to the chicken chiller. And if you remember last season in the finale episode, Werner was on the phone with someone he thought worked for Gus who turned out to be Lalo. And he talked about how his men, you know, the concrete was ready to start the construction of the south wall and his men could start it without him because he was at this spa. And Lalo picked up on the south wall, and he specifically like asked Werner, that's the south wall, and he had Werner reiterate it, so he remembered the south wall. And in this scene that all comes back,
Because this place has got four walls.
This place has four walls, and they are fully constructed.
Yeah.
And this is no more than a day later.
Mm-hmm.
So Lalo knows that Gus is lying to him when he sees the south wall already constructed. And I love that about Better Call Saul, how they don't hold your hand, right? There's no flashback. There's no, like, oh, remember when this happened.
Right.
In the episode, they just expect you to kind of remember it, and they have a lot of faith in their audience. And that's always been, like, a hallmark of Breaking Bad, you know, when the rice and cigarette comes back in Breaking Bad, like, they don't expect you, they expect you to remember, oh, Walt made this ricin and they put it in this cigarette and they were trying to kill Gus with it, and like all of this stuff that just is sort of built into a single line here.
Right.
It's fantastic.
It's great. It's very tight writing.
Oh yeah. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. So Bolsa is pissed about Lala's meddling and tells Lalo that Gus is all about business and that this feud they've got going on is over. And Lalo asks if he trusts Fring, but he doesn't really answer. He says all that matters is Fring brings in the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that attitude is probably going to get them all killed later on in Breaking Bad.
You think so?
Yeah. I mean, they trusted too much in Gus because he brought in the money.
Yeah.
There is a line here about a place called Santiago.
Yeah, and I would love to know what happened in Santiago. Lalo is implying that Gus fucked up somehow in Santiago.
That he fucked up?
Yeah, I think so. Because, yeah, because Juan Bolsa was he asked him if he trusted him, and he said, yeah, I do. And then Lalo, I almost called him Lola, whoops, Lalo says something to the effect of, what about Santiago?
Ah, right. Yeah, so Santiago, if you don't know, is the capital of Chile.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Gus has a sordid history of some kind in the Pinochet regime in Chile. And I'm really hoping that we get some more backstory, some more information on Gus's time in Chile, because it's one of the big questions, the big unanswered questions we had about Breaking Bad that you don't really need an answer to, because Gus, you know, he's a scary enough character without knowing his backstory.
That almost makes it more scary, not knowing just how bad it possibly is.
It could, but now I think is the time, if you're going to reveal that information.
Absolutely.
You've got two seasons left.
Yep.
Let's do it. Let's hear all about Gus's backstory. Let's get another Coati story about Pinochet and how he had to, like, I don't know, line up 15 civilians on a wall and do some deeds that better left unspoken.
Covered all of his furniture in Coati coats.
Oh, man.
Yeah. The cutest armchair you've ever seen in your life.
He carpeted his shower floor with Coati fur.
Oh, that's gross on multiple levels. That just made me so uncomfortable. Oh my God. Imagine your feet being in that while it's wet.
Oh yeah. Gus loves it. Gus just, he wriggles his toes around in that Coati fur. That wet, wet Coati fur.
He nasty.
He sure is. Yeah, so hopefully we'll find out more information about Santiago.
And hopefully it won't be that.
It can't be that. All right. Saul's running a free phone tent at ABQ's Freak Central while pitching them on his law services. And beautifully, he brands himself the Magic Man. And the Magic Man is on speed dial. Just hit number one. Poof, I'm there. It's fan-fucking-tastic. I love the persona of the Magic Man.
It's ridiculous. I love the way that this scene is shot, too. It's has like this almost chaotic but also very driven energy to it. It's very, like, you know, snapping the fingers salesman.
Yeah, it's
con man kind of,
like, a snowballing kind of scene too, where we start off slow and he gives each person, you can see each person who comes in, he gives them a bespoke pitch, right? Like, he takes one look at them,
profiles them
and then says, I know what's gonna sell my law services to this person,
right? Not like he really has to do much.
That's what
he has
Jimmy
free
does
phones, but
right, like Jimmy, he reads people. That's what a con man does.
Exactly.
He figures out by looking at you, by talking to you, what you want, and he pretends to give that to you.
Right.
Or he does give that to you, but he gets what he wants.
Exactly.
And in this case, what he wants is your legal dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting free cell phones, so that's pretty cool. There's a scene at the end of this, or a moment at the end of this scene where nobody is really there for his law services. They're all there for the free phones. I think literally they're all there for the free phones. Like, I think he set up a tent near an underpass.
I'm just wondering.
And everyone just, like, this Fast and Furious Marilyn Manson concert that's happening is all because Saul is there giving away free phones.
I'm just wondering how the fuck he advertised this. Was he putting it on phone poles or something to, like, or was it a trail of banners leading to this underpass? How did that work?
Know.
What came first?
Maybe he sent, like, a text to all these burners that... Why would they need free phones if they got burners already?
The friends might need free phones.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure how he got the word out, but he did. And everybody came.
He sure did.
But nobody wants his legal services, and so he gives away this... He does the thing that Kim said would reflect poorly on him.
Well, that he said, thinks she
right,
said would reflect poorly on him.
That
yeah,
he said, oh, yeah, I don't want to do that. You're right. He does it anyway when he realizes his ploy has not worked and gives away 50% off specifically felony
nonviolent felony defense. Very specific.
Very specific. And I can't help but think that this is going to lead into, like,
people doing nonviolent felonies.
Yeah. Like, I guess because you look at the people here, right? And as soon as he says, oh, 50% off, they realize, like, what must be going on in their head is, I'm probably going to commit a felony tonight. A nonviolent one, though. And
well,
I might need these legal services.
50% off. It's an interesting statement. 50% off what?
Yeah.
It's a cool thing. It could be literally anything because there was no number. We have not established a number already.
Yeah, that's the beauty of sales where people don't know the prices of the services or they don't understand necessarily the value of the service and the standard pricing for it.
Right.
Because, you know, let's say Jimmy's rate is $50 an hour, $100 an hour, $200. You double it and you take 50% off that, suddenly you're getting your full rate and they think they're getting a discount. So, although I don't know how much money these people have.
I bet a lot of these people, if they have been brought in before, they've only had public defenders.
Yeah.
They haven't had to pay for anything because they've...
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. And also, the felonies is a delightful touch because if you do the same crime a certain number of times, it becomes a felony. It doesn't have to be the first...
That's true.
You know, that whole repeat offender thing.
Yeah. And having him as number one on the speed dial is just so perfect. That's
such
a
sticker.
The
sticker is amazing.
The sticker?
Yeah, there was a sticker literally like that pointed to and encircled the number one.
On the phone?
On the phones.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he flips one open in like the very first part of the scene.
Wow.
And you see it. It's wonderful.
I did notice the shaky cam in this scene. It's a little too shaky for my taste.
Didn't even notice
like,
it.
Hard to watch kind of shaky.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe it was just me. My old eyes.
Your old eyes.
All right, let's move on to Mike taking the construction crew out to the desert and telling them that they're being paid in full for a half-done job and making sure that they keep silent about it. And they all drive to different cities to fly out from different airports. Seems to be going well until Kai...
Opens his mouth,
which he's known for. It's kind of his thing. Says Werner was too soft and had to be killed, and Mike just blasts him in the face.
You can tell he's thinking, you son of a bitch, I had to kill this guy, and he was way better than you. And then that gets turned right back around on him.
It absolutely does, because Casper walks up, some guy who is named Casper that I don't think we've ever really seen before.
He's tall.
And he's very tall. He's very big, intimidating. Mike's probably not young enough to fuck with him anymore.
But he's still, he has that confidence of... being in this business for a long time, he's just like, yeah.
Oh,
he's
got
something to say. Fucking say it, man.
I don't think Mike's scared of him, but Mike's not going to take the same shot he would as he did to Kai.
Right.
But yeah, this guy says Werner was worth 50 of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I agree. Like, and it stings Mike because Mike knows, right? But
Werner
was a gentle soul, an innocent man. Mike is none of those things. Mike is so closed off. Mike barely has a relationship with his family.
And
Mike
is
a murderer. Like, you know, it's a revenge murder and maybe a justified one, but he's a murderer. He's also running the drug operation or at least contributing to the drug operations in Albuquerque. Like, there's a lot of shit that Mike has done bad and wrong. Werner was innocent.
Yeah, he was just a little bit of a goof.
Yeah.
And that is why I got him killed.
I think, I don't know if Kai is necessarily right about him being soft, but I think he was certainly in over his head and didn't realize it.
There's a certain naivete to Werner. The caliber of the people he was dealing with.
Right.
Yeah.
And the seriousness of his situation and the consequences of his actions.
Yep.
So yeah, I think I agree with Casper.
We also, I don't know if this is something that we know in Better Call Saul necessarily, but I think in Breaking Bad, we know just exactly what happened to his son, Mike's son, and how that all went down.
Yeah, we know in Better Call Saul.
Okay. I couldn't remember if we did or not, but we know that Mike was a dirty cop and he got his son killed.
Yeah. I think that's in this series.
Okay.
And then also he, you know, we know the whole revenge story where he goes after these cops and
Okay.
all that.
So yeah, he's not a great dude.
No, he's not. He's a guy you can respect.
He's super competent. He is nice to his family.
Yeah, and Walt's a guy you can respect in certain ways. But like, there are other things about him that outweigh any kind of respect you'd have for him, right? Like his hubris.
But I still like Mike more than Walt.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Walt's a piece of shit.
I think it's because Mike has less of an ego.
It might be.
Yeah. Anyway, so Mike reports the job done to Gus. They got these people out of here, and Gus says, well, we can't continue building until we deal with Lalo, and Mike will still get paid for his portion of the job, and even offers him sort of a retainer here to keep him on while they're waiting to begin construction again. And then Gus says the Werner's wife was lied to about Werner dying in a construction accident, and she was paid off, and they think that it's all smoothed over, which really gets to Mike. And if you remember, and it's so much so that he tells him, like, fuck your retainer, I don't want it. Mm-hmm. And I think Mike is trying to quit.
Soft quit, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he wants to be a part of this anymore after what happened with Werner.
Right.
And you can look at it, and if you remember back to, it might have been last season, it might have been the season before, but the church support group that Mike was in,
mm-hmm.
and the relationship that he formed with the woman there, whose name I don't remember, the sort of backstory of that character, the reason she was in group is because her husband had disappeared while hiking.
Mm-hmm.
Just gone. She didn't know what happened to him, right? And so when Gus says, oh yeah, we lied to Werner's wife, mm-hmm. and she just thinks there was a construction accident, I think not knowing, the fact that she doesn't really know what happened to him is what gets Mike here. And Mike says, you know,
parallels
fuck
that
you.
Experience he's already had. I didn't even think about that.
Right. That's, he's so angry. And his own son too, right? For the longest time, he didn't know what happened to Maddie.
Mm-hmm.
He figured it out eventually, but he had to do a lot of tracking to do that. So like he understands, I think, very intimately what it feels like to lose someone and not be quite sure what happened to them.
Right.
All right. So next scene is the guy that I call Petty with a Prior, because that's how we were introduced to him. Just Petty with a Prior. That's all he says.
I call him Pathetic Chipman.
Pathetic Chipman. That's a good one. I think his real name is Bill.
Bill Oakley. DDA, specifically Bill Oakley, which okay. I did not realize until I looked it up for this episode.
District Defense Attorney?
No.
What does that stand for?
Deputy District Attorney.
Deputy District Attorney.
Yeah. So he's a little higher up than the
really?
Public defenders. Yeah. I never okay. would have guessed, because he has such powerful lawyer from Scrubs energy sometimes. Maybe uh-huh. it's just the baldness.
Yeah.
He's not as sweaty.
Less sweating. Yeah.
Or tall.
Yeah. I feel you. That's strange.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So Bill has trouble getting a bag of chips, and there's this really nice shot where we're looking out of the vending machine at
him. Chip's eye view. Yeah.
From behind the chips, and you can see like that whole operation goes wrong for him. Everything goes wrong for this guy. Especially in this scene where Saul causes a big scene, a big to-do in the lobby with his film crew, yeah. who he has paid to pretend to be a news crew so that he can gin up business and essentially do a live commercial, a live ad for the people sitting around in
exactly.
the courthouse waiting for, you know, prosecution or whatever the hell they got going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really small scale. It's strange to me because like Jimmy doesn't normally operate and think so small, where he's gonna do this commercial for like two people sitting in the lobby.
Right.
So maybe there's more to it. Maybe they are filming. Maybe he's gonna use his footage somehow to do something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But as on the face of it here, this is him doing a performance piece to gin up business in the courthouse.
Right.
And man, I don't remember her name. But the student, the female student, her spray tan is so bad. It's like,
it's very early 90s. I will say your hair and everything is, wow, it is a lot of that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And there's a line in here that I absolutely love. And it's the most obvious line, the line that has to be spoken. But it's the way that this guy who plays Petty with a Prior delivers it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jimmy comes up. Jimmy McGill, famous in the public defense courthouse atmosphere, right? This Bill guy has been working with him for years. Jimmy comes up
suspended.
And says, I'm Saul Goodman.
Yeah.
And he's got a mouthful of sandwich and or chips or whatever. And he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't understand, like, what is this case? I've never heard of this case.
Mm-hmm.
And he just says, like, after Jimmy's going on, Saul Goodman, he says, you're who? He's so confused. You're who? You're Saul Goodman? Who is Saul Goodman? You're Jimmy McGill.
Yeah.
I love it.
And he's the exact person to be confronted with this, because he is the kind of guy who is going to be so flabbergasted that he can't speak.
Yeah. Yeah,
he's
so confused in this scene. I love it.
I also love just the way that this whole scene is shot, the way that we are introduced to this Saul Goodman scheme. It almost makes it, it's like how you would feel to be just a normal person and then suddenly be confronted with this.
With the Jimmyverse.
The Jimmyverse, yeah. Just to have this come into your orbit. It's insane. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
As opposed to coming at it from Jimmy's side.
Right. I don't think Petty with Pryor is a bad guy.
Mm-mm.
He's a little pathetic. I don't know that he's like a normal person, but you know, he's got a law degree. Like he was motivated at one point. So I don't know. I feel a little
sympathy for him.
Once.
Right?
He had dreams.
He had ambitions.
They obviously got crushed. They obviously got ground into the dirt by hours of public defense, hours and decades probably.
And bags of chips every day.
Oh yeah.
Dude's got rowdy poops. That's all I'm saying.
He needs to go find that better,
sandwich vending machine.
Yeah, yep. The better machine. Maybe we should go to the last scene and we could talk about that.
Let's do it.
Where Kim advises a guy that she is defending not to take his case to trial. But this guy thinks that the jury's going to like him because he has a family, I guess.
Because he has a pregnant girlfriend.
Which
yeah.
seemed to be an afterthought to him. Like when
Absolutely.
She mentions, oh, do you want to be there? I guess I understand. Like you want to be there for
the delivery. And he was
right?
like,
he's like,
I'm not expecting a pack. Oh, the baby. Right.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah. Which should be first and foremost on his mind, but it's clearly not. And then Saul shows up for lunch and hatches a scheme to get this guy to take the plea bargain. And Kim has to very, very sternly tell Jimmy to fuck off. Back off is what she says. But
she says she says the same thing in four different, much nicer ways before she has to tell him to back off.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, it builds. She's so great.
Oh, Racy Horn. I can't say enough good about Racy Horn. She's fantastic. And this scene is the prime example. She's so good in this scene. Because once Saul leaves, she decides, actually, that idea is really good.
Mm-hmm. That might be the only thing that's going to work.
And she decides to go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And then afterward, she feels like shit having done it. And like, that's the thing. This is why I say there's a huge trust issue between them, because she goes ahead with what she recognizes is a good scheme,
mm-hmm.
reluctantly, but she does so without Jimmy.
Right.
And I think that's the only way she would go ahead with this, because she doesn't trust Jimmy. Jimmy's too unpredictable. Jimmy's willing to go too far in his schemes, willing to take too big a risk for her.
It's almost like she's a little afraid to encourage it at this point.
Uh-huh.
Because she is worried that it's going to get crazier and crazier. And as we know from Breaking Bad, it absolutely does.
Right. But also she thinks, I think she thinks she can control the scheme better than Jimmy. And
maybe.
That might be her downfall. Like something, I don't know, something bad is going to happen to her. We still don't know where Kim ends up in the
mm-hmm.
Breaking Bad era.
Yeah.
If they're together, if she's alive.
Right.
There's so many things that could happen between now and then. Could she go off the deep end with one of these schemes? Think that, well, Jimmy's just sloppy. And if I can scheme, I'm smarter than Jimmy. I'm more careful than Jimmy. I'm more calculated. It's, you know, Walter White was the same way. Like he looked at the schemes and said, well, I'm so careful and calculated and intelligent that none of this could possibly backfire on me. And inevitably
mm-hmm.
it did.
Mm-hmm.
So like Kim might find herself in the same spot, sort of taking the spirit of Jimmy and trying to mold it in ways that suit her, that she might not be prepared to work with.
Yeah. She's definitely, you can tell, she's visibly, after she does do this scheme, she goes to her normal freaking out stairwell. And she is just like visibly mad and disappointed and kind of disgusted with herself.
Oh, yeah. There's disgust in Jimmy and herself here.
Yeah.
Like when she goes along with this scheme on her own terms, there's a moment where like you can tell she doesn't want to do it. She recognizes it might be the only thing that would fix this problem. And I think you have to know that there is a lot of work involved for her if this thing goes to trial,
mm-hmm.
right? It's much easier to get them to sign this plea bargain or whatever it is, settlement, and just, you know, push it off her plate.
But also, we know that she's coming to this public defense as kind of a way of like clearing her conscience a little bit, or just doing some good. Mm-hmm. And it is true that 5 months in prison for this dude with a family that's about to expand is way better than like a year and a half or 5 years.
Oh yeah. And she really believes that he will get time.
She does.
Bigger time if he takes this to trial. Yeah, it's a fantastic acting job here, because you can see the moment where she turns and then how hard that is for her. Like there's a point where she rolls her eyes, she swallows really hard.
I was gonna say,
like,
yeah, she does so much acting with her eyes and her like jaw muscles.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Fantastic.
But yeah, you could see that moment when it changes. Just like with Jimmy.
That's it for the episode.
That's it.
Got anything else you want to say? I don't think we have any feedback this week. So if you do have feedback that you'd like to send in, you can do so at bettercastsaul@baldmove.com. We'll get those messages, we'll compile them, and we will read feedback. We had a lawyer write in this week, our resident Better Call Saul lawyer, Doug L. But he said there wasn't much to talk about here this week, which I agree with.
Fair.
So we're not going to read anything from him. But thank you, Doug. And also, anybody else who wants to write in for next week's, or I guess tomorrow's podcast. We actually, if you didn't know, there's a second episode of Better Call Saul out right now. Season 5, they released these back
to back. It's great. I loved it.
So we'll be talking about that episode tomorrow. So look for that in your podcast feed. And until then, I'm Jim.
I have a thing to say still.
And until then, this podcast is... Oh, no. What did you want to say?
Oh, never mind.
Do it.
Forget it.
Bring it.
Forget it.
No, I want to hear it.
It's not happening.
We're not ending this podcast until I hear it.
The thing that I loved about Breaking Bad and that I continue to love about Better Call Saul is how well they write their characters. Mm-hmm. And there are very few characters whose perspectives that we see that feel like throwaway characters.
Yeah.
So my question for you is, who do you think is kind of the MVP of this episode? Who is like, whose storyline are you the most excited to see?
I mean, it's Saul.
Expand. Saul.
It's Saul. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't Saul. Saul.
Yeah.
We've been waiting 5 seasons to see Saul turn into Saul, Jimmy turn into Saul,
That's
and now
true.
It's here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm super excited to see like 2 episodes of that.
Very specific.
I don't want to see just Saul being Saul. And mm-hmm. that's always been like the danger of this show, is if we turn Saul into Saul too early.
Yeah.
Like he'll just become overused. He'll become something that people don't enjoy seeing anymore, because Saul is good in moderation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that Saul, the persona, is great all the time. So I'm really invested in Jimmy and Kim's relationship.
Yeah.
But Saul is the thing I loved most about this episode.
Totally. That makes sense.
How about you?
I am really interested to see exactly what goes down with the Salamancas.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I've like latched onto Nacho pretty hard as a character.
He's really sympathetic.
He's very sympathetic.
A drug dealer.
That's the thing, is that he's a nice person also. It seems like he treats his dad really well. He treats the women he's with really well.
He
like,
tries to treat his underling dealers really well, but he keeps getting pushed into beating the shit out of them.
Exactly.
By his bosses.
So like obviously he's not that great of a person, because he can do that stuff.
Right, right.
But also he's nice in other ways. I don't know.
And there's a sense of
cute too.
Self-preservation. Yeah, he's cute, of course. but the self-preservation is what's motivating him and what's causing him to do the bad things at this point. And, you know, that worked so well with Walt up to a point. Like, his motives were very sympathetic in the beginning.
Right.
Like, I just want to get, I'm about to die. I want to get my family money. Nacho is like, my father's getting sucked into this. I want to get him out.
Right.
And that's the driving force for Nacho. And so it's real easy to get on his side,
because
we've seen how good his father is.
Yeah. I'm really interested to see if he can stay that person with like that kernel of goodness in him, or if he is going to go to the dark side, become a total piece of shit like Walt.
I don't think Nacho's the guy who's going to turn to a piece of shit. I think it's Jimmy.
Well, we know it's Jimmy.
Yeah, if anybody's going to turn to piece of shit.
Possibly Kim too. We'll see.
We'll see. We don't know much about him.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm excited. I just wanted to talk about characters for a minute.
Me too. And I'm ready to talk about episode 2.
Me too. Not today, though.
No. But we will see you back here tomorrow for that. And until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Alexis. Bye.